For the week of October 19th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 254, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, this is the week.
It is?
It absolutely is. It is the week that all of our listeners will understand why it is they listen to our show every single week. What keeps bringing them back?
The dulcet tones of your voice?
Well, yeah. Well, yes, in a way, yes, because it is the dulcet tones of both of our voices telling them everything they need to know about the entertainment industry around the world and how often we are right about what we are predicting for the future of the entertainment industry.
Can you be more specific, especially about this show?
Well, on this week's show, we'll be talking about Time Warner's decision to go over the top, something we talked about on episode 234, by the way. Now, if you're confused by what we're referencing when we say over the top, then we have an old phonograph, a Speak and Spell, and a golf umbrella you can use to phone home. And if you don't understand how those last three items can be used to make a phone call to outer space, well, then you're probably born before 1982, or at the very least, you're not listening to this show. What am I talking about? You may be asking.
No, I don't know.
you don't know? Well, I'm talking about Time Warner's decision to make HBO available to those who don't subscribe via their cable provider here in the United States. And by the way, those last three items, that was a reference to E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works.
Well, because you must be an alien if you don't know about
Oh, God. Okay, keep going.
Well, indeed, Time Warner, they are making it available, HBO that is, to those who don't even subscribe to cable, aka cord cutters. And what did the broadcast network CBS have to say about all of this? I believe the common vernacular would be described as, me too, me too. In other words, they're launching their own OTT service. In fact, Time Warner had a host of announcements during their investor meeting last week, which all have us writing thank you notes to Rupert Murdoch. And it turns out Amazon has figured out a way to get along with publishers, at least one of them. They cut a deal with Simon & Schuster. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about box office around the world, not just in North America, but the box office from every country in the world combined into one big chart. We pull our info from Box Office Mojo, which seems to be back and in place and not going anywhere. I don't know why they disappeared briefly last week, but they did. Now they're back, and we pulled domestic information from them. And we also pull from Box Office Mojo, we pull the budgets of the films. They're one really good source that we use because they always include the info, then we try to confirm it from somewhere else. And then we go to RentTrack for information on box office around the world. And 13 movies this week made $10 million or more around the world. So it was a very busy week with a lot of joy spread to a lot of different films around the world. And the number one movie around the world is Gone Girl, the David Fincher film, another $38 million. It passed the $200 million mark. As we predicted, it will probably become Fincher's highest grossing film of all time.
Well, that's an impossible feat there that Gone Girl is the number one movie in around the world, because Fury was number one here at home with $23.5 million. So, Gone Girl could not possibly have won the weekend.
Well, I'm not sure if you understand how worldwide box office works. We don't just pick the top winner in North America or the top winner in Germany or Japan. We add them all up and then we say who won everywhere. So Fury is the number one movie in North America, but it only opened in North America. That's the Brad Pitt World War II film, a Sam Fuller-esque movie that got solid reviews. And I know at least one friend of the show, Aaron, really enjoyed the movie when he saw it. $23.5 million it made in North America. So that's a good, solid start for that film. And number two around the world is Dracula Untold. This is the reboot that Universal was hoping for. That studio has monster movies in their DNA. Frankenstein, Dracula, The Wolfman, you name it. The Invisible Man, The Mummy. They were hoping Dracula Untold would sort of help to start create a Universal monster universe. They did it way back when. They would have crossovers with The Mummy and Frankenstein and Dracula and even with Abbott and Costello. They're hoping to do that again, but this movie got very poor reviews. However, it's doing okay at the box office. $32 million worldwide. It's at $136 million and counting. It cost about $70 million, so it needs to get to $210 million in order to be a hit, as far as how we judge a hit. And it looks like it's going to get there.
Well, you know, you say that Universal has monster DNA in their, or monster movies in their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And that is specifically why at inter-society meetings, I sit on the opposite side of the room from the Universal executives, just in case, just in case.
And at number three is Annabelle, the low-budget spinoff from The Conjuring. It grossed $27 million worldwide, and it's at $166 million and counting. It's very successful indeed. At number four is The Book of Life, the animated film about the Day of the Dead. Is that what it's about? No, 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 no. What's the Book of Life?
You know what? I tried to say it yesterday, and a native Spanish speaker corrected me so harshly that I'm not even going to try it now.
I don't blame you. So it's The Book of Life. It's an animated film. It stars Channing Tatum as one of the voice actors, among many others. It grossed $25 million in its opening weekend around the world in 20 different territories.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be quite good.
I haven't seen it yet. It got pretty good reviews. And number five is Guardians of the Galaxy, still tearing it up in China. That's basically where it's making most of its money, though it's still playing in 23 territories. It grossed $24 million this weekend. It's at $732 million. If you ignore Spidey, because Spider-Man is put out by a different studio. If you look at the Marvel films that have come first from Marvel, then Marvel and Disney, Guardians of the Galaxy is the third highest grossing Marvel film of all time.
Wow.
The only two movies bigger are The Avengers and Iron Man 3. That's mean Guardians of the Galaxy has made more money than Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, Captain America 1, Captain America 2, Thor 1, Thor 2, and you know what? The Spidey reboot, it's going to pass those as well.
And you know what? Trying to adjust for inflation there doesn't even matter because they're all pretty much within the last 10 years.
Bless you for saying that. So the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies made by a different studio, they're peaking at about $800 to $900 million. So the Guardians of the Galaxy is going to get even close to that, though it's probably going to tap out at about, I don't know, $700, $800 million, I think. So it probably won't pass those. But even those are within reach. So this is a movie nobody knew about. People did not know these characters. I mean, you may not read comic books, but you know Captain America. You probably heard of Thor. A lot of people didn't know Iron Man, but nobody other than comic book people had heard of Guardians of the Galaxy. So that makes, I think, this all the more impressive.
And I'll tell you, when it was shown at CinemaCon back in March of this year, a lot of exhibitors, a lot of movie theater owners were raising their eyebrows thinking, whoa, wait
a second. What the heck is this?
Yeah, there's a talking raccoon in this, and I don't know what that tree thing is, but it only has the one line. So I don't know about this. This does not look like a real winner. But you know what? You can't judge something necessarily on 4 or 5 or 10 minutes worth of footage.
Oh, I can. At number seven, skipping over Fury, which we already talked about, is The Maze Runner, another $21 million. It's at $250 million and counting, followed by Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That reboot is at $20 million. It's at $375 million worldwide. Robert Downey Jr., forever known as Iron Man, his movie The Judge is a serious drama. It grossed $14 million and it's at $35 million, followed by Denzel Washington with his potential franchise, The Equalizer. That grossed $13 million, and that's at $160 million worldwide. When you look at Denzel, we talked about him a few weeks ago as a real movie star. He always opens his movies in North America. They make good coin overseas, so he's really a solid star. He also has a very specific range. Almost all of his movies will make between $150 million and $250 million. He has not really broken through to $3-4, half a billion dollar range. So if you're making his movies, you know you're going to bring in an audience. And if you keep the budget within $50 and $70 million, chances are you're going to make your money back.
But at the same time, I would add that unlike, say, a Samuel L. Jackson, I'm trying to think of somebody else.
Well, he doesn't headline a lot of movies, unlike Denzel Washington.
Yeah, that's
terrific
true.
Terrific actor, but he is not the leading actor of most of his movies. Great actor, no question about that. But it's a different thing.
But he doesn't, like, then go and do, like, an Iron Man or even an Oblivion.
Well,
or,
but that's why he has, I mean, that's the question. Has he not made those movies because he hasn't had the chance? Or has he not made those movies because he's not that type of actor? Or is that just not his wheelhouse? You know, is he smart about making the right movies for himself? He certainly could have been an action star. He's made big budget films. Looking at his track record, you would probably say, hey, it's not a good idea to make $130 million with Denzel Washington. But that may be putting the cart before the horse. Like you say, well, guess what? If he'd made those big movies, maybe he would have a $500 million, you know, movie in his itinerary.
Yeah, because he's traveling to every single one of these big budget movies.
That's right. At number 11 is Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. That grossed $13 million and it's at $45 million and counting. The Best of Me. This opened in seven territories, but mostly in North America. It grossed $11 million, and I'm pretty sure it's one of the worst cast films of the year.
So it's not the best of whoever is in that film.
Well, it's not that the actors are bad, but James Marsden plays Dawson. And by the way, I thought the name Dawson was forever taken. I don't think you could call a character Dawson anymore unless you're making Dawson's Creek the movie. But anyway, he plays a character named Dawson, and it's based on a Nicholas Sparks novel. It's a weepy. And then newcomer Luke Bracey plays younger Dawson. You know, this is supposed to be the teenage Dawson followed by the middle-aged Dawson who reunites with his true love.
Wait a second. Didn't I see this movie before? Wasn't it called The Notebook?
The problem is Luke Bracey looks practically the same age as James Marsden, and I think he's taller. So I think he's shrunk and looks completely different once he gets into being his late 30s or 40s. It's just ridiculous.
Well, you know, according to many doctors, we shrink as we get older.
Not that much.
Okay.
He doesn't look like a teenager, and he doesn't look like James Marsden. That's bad casting. So anyway, there's a couple other movies. You jump way down. Breakup Buddies, by the way, that's the last film in the $10 million club. That's the Chinese buddy comedy. It's raunchy. It's funny. It's made $165 million. And towards the bottom, one of the only new film on the chart this week is La Dictatura Perfecta, which is The Perfect Dictatorship. It's a Mexican comedy. It's a political satire about a corrupt governor. It was co-written, produced, and directed by Luis Estrada, whose last film was a satire of the drug trade.
So wait a second. This is a Mexican film called The Perfect Dictator, right?
The Perfect Dictatorship, La Dictatura Perfecta.
It's a Mexican comedy about a corrupt governor, a.k.a. The News.
Well... corrupt governors all over the world. Are you saying Mexico's more corrupt than the U.S.?
No, I'm just saying that,
bastard,
you know,
you're driving away our Mexican audience.
I'm just saying during this time period right now, there happens to be a lot of news coming out of Mexico about corrupt politicians.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know if that's, you know, indicative.
That's just this week's news. Next yes. week? I guess our governors just run off to have romances and disappear from view for weeks at a time.
Oh my gosh, that's a callback from I don't even know when.
The only thing I'm wondering about on the worldwide box office is that One Direction film. It's One Direction, Where We Are. It played one weekend only, and we only have like info about $5 million of grosses on that. I imagine it grossed more.
Here's the thing with that. I found out about that, actually, and I forgot to tell you. It was considered an alternative content or an event.
I understand.
Oh, okay.
But nonetheless, though, we get information on like the Met, you know, when they have movies. Isn't that alternative content?
That is considered alternative content. It is more a part of the system at this point because they have like a whole series and there's a way to track it now. Whereas these one-offs, who's the distributor? How are we finding out about those grosses? It's a little bit harder.
Well, the Met did one of their live, I think it was The Marriage of Figaro, and I think it grossed like 1 million, 2 million. I shouldn't say because I don't have the figures in front of me. But, you know, we see that sometimes. But but this one just went way under the radar. You would think they'd want to publicize more how well it did.
Well, they did, but after they tabulated everything.
Well, but I can't imagine it peaked at $5 million. I mean, their last movie made $68 million.
Right, but there was like a limited showing in some markets. It only showed once. Literally, it had one showing.
Well, okay. My point is, what a botched release of a One Direction film if they ended up only grossing $5 million worldwide.
They're not looking at it as a film. They're looking at it as an event.
I'm looking at it as a film. They could have released it commercially and made maybe $10 million, $12 million, $20 million. Based on momentum alone, you would think a One Direction film would gross, you know, I mean, this just makes it one of the highest grossing concert films of all time. But you would think since their last film grossed $68 million that this film would gross, I don't know, 10, 15, you know, that's if it collapses. They grossed only about five. That seems like a lot of money left on the table. I don't care how you label it. That seems like a really botched job with One Direction.
Well, I think also they were trying to make it a...
They failed.
Well, I think it depends
whatever
on...
Whatever they tried to do, their last movie grossed $68 million. The band is not that much less hot. You know, they're still a very big band worldwide. They've still got hit singles. They got a new album coming out shortly. There's no reason why this movie should have been such a relative flop.
Well, and I think they would probably, they being the folks handling One Direction and handling this particular event, would say, look, we have very specific goals for this movie, and we have very...
make less money?
They may not have had the money to market
it. Success! What, they are one of the biggest acts in the world. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah,
what,
they're
not yesterday's news. This isn't a concert film of New Kids on the Block today. This is a concert film of the boy band of the moment. One of the biggest musical acts in the world.
And it still requires somebody to put money into marketing, put money into production.
Well, of course it does, but who would not do that? Why would you suddenly say, well, we're not going to make money on this film? Their last movie grossed $68 million worldwide.
And what some would say is that movie was what, earlier this year, right?
I think so.
Right. So why do another one so quickly after the first one?
Then don't make the movie. Wait until you want to release it and make it then and release it so you can make more money. What are you talking about? They spent money to shoot this film. I don't think it cost $50,000. So whatever they spent.
It was live. So they basically did a live production.
It was not live. They showed it multiple times. It was not just one screening one day.
I thought it was just a live event.
Maybe it was a live stream?
I thought so, yeah. It was like basically a concert.
They had it over 2 days.
Right, well, because they stored in... So they basically...
Well, of course.
Yeah.
whatever. So you're saying they kept the cost much lower?
Yes.
By just live streaming it?
Yes.
Sounds like a botched job to me. I mean, I understand Morgan Spurlock was not there running around filming you, but I don't understand it. $5 million makes it one of the highest grossing concert films of all time. I'll grant you that.
And I think it's also one of the highest grossing event cinema, you know, alternative content events of all time. Yeah,
I'm sure. Nonetheless, it seems weird. Don't you think, gee, when they filmed it and released it, they made $68 million. This one night event that they showed over two nights made about $5 million, and they seem to be embarrassed about how much it made, because it's hard to find info on it. It's only mentioned tangentially in a few news stories by, you know, trade papers. It's not like they were touting the sales and grosses of this project and said, look at this great success for this one-night event. They barely mentioned it. One source says it grossed $3.4 million in North America alone. That's what confuses me. If it's that much, then... how come it didn't make a lot more in the rest of the world? You got the UK. That's their home country. I just don't understand. It's not well reported. I don't know what's going on. I need more information. I don't know. They're either ashamed about it or they're not. But to me, this is a big question mark. If anybody knows, fill us in.
You know, I actually want to just take that last bit that you just said there and just make that like a sound loop. I'm all confused. It's underreported. I need more information.
I just hate it that we don't have TV ratings. I hate it when we don't, you know, we're spoiled now. We have information on box office from around the world. And sometimes info's not included and it drives me nuts. You know, we miss out on a certain country or thing because RenTrak isn't perfect. They can only report info that they're given. So, you know, they're not guaranteeing every country in the world for every local hit. They're covering as well as they can big releases from big studios. But there are films probably in France and Germany and Argentina and other countries that are big hits locally that might have made it onto this chart. Because we tap out at $2.4 million. That's a South Korean film. There's probably some local movie somewhere in the world that made more money than that. You know, and we don't have info on it because not every film in every territory gets reported to RenTrak. It's really, as much as anything, the big studios around the world that get their info to them. So there's gaps in our knowledge. It drives me nuts.
Well, and just some further information on this One Direction thing. It was produced by Arts Alliance. It was an event cinema thing. Sony Music helped produce it. And it was a concert film that was meant to be a one-off. And I have a feeling it made $15 million globally, by the way.
I only saw $5 million. It made $15 million.
Yes.
Well, that's better.
$15 million globally in limited showings. And
so it was shown more than once. So yeah, you're saying it was live streamed once and then you could watch the rerun.
Right, correct. And so you probably once or twice. And really, this was probably done for an eventual DVD release of that concert.
Well, I'm sure it will be, just like the other one was.
So if you're
$15 million is better than five.
Saying is they're leaving money on the table.
Perhaps. I mean, they probably spent a lot more. Do we know the budget?
No, but for a live production, it's not. I mean, trust me, they made money.
Well, I'm God help them if they didn't. I mean, You know, you can't expect a concert film to make $15 million worldwide automatically, even if your last one did make $68 million. But thanks for the extra information.
You know who else also believes that they're leaving money on the table?
Who's that?
Time Warner. And I don't mean Time Warner Cable, which is the cable company, which is different from Time Warner, the media company. They think they're leaving money on the table.
And how's that?
Well, they believe that, I guess they have, what, 30 million homes subscribe to HBO, which is a Time Warner company.
That's in North America.
That's in North America. But they are not reaching 80 million homes. And that's according to Richard Plepler, the CEO and chairman of HBO.
And so that's why HBO announced that they're going over the top. Like a soldier in the trenches in World War One, they're going over the top. What does that mean?
It means that they are like a soldier in World War One. They're going over the top of the trenches. What did you say? Whatever you just said.
I just said it. What does it mean technologically?
Oh, okay. It means that you're going over the top of the set-top box. In other words, you are going direct to consumers via the internet. You're not going through a cable provider. You're not doing it linearly.
Satellite.
Right. It's IPTV rather than traditional broadcast or cable television.
And this made headlines everywhere.
Yes.
This was big. This was front page news, at least online. I don't know if you can talk about front page anymore, but I didn't look at a physical edition of a newspaper. Might have been the front page of USA Today. That's the sort of thing they do. But it was big news for everybody.
HBO could
be available without cable.
Yes. I think it caused Twitter to explode, actually. And Richard Plepler said during this was a Time Warner investor day. So Time Warner, the media company, had this day for investors to come and ask all these questions and analysts. And he said, and this is the poll quote, "In 2015, we will go beyond the wall and launch a standalone over-the-top service with the potential to produce hundreds of millions of dollars of additional revenue. And the international possibilities could be just as large, if not larger." I love that beyond the wall.
Beyond the wall. It sounds like Game of Thrones. And he means specifically HBO.
Yes. And they're actually really targeting. And he said this. We're targeting these not only the 80 million, but 10 million homes that pay for broadband but do not have TV at all. These cable cutters, no cable, no satellite. And he says that is a large and growing opportunity that should no longer be left untapped. It is time to remove all barriers to those who want HBO. And
oh
it was
my God, it's like the Berlin Wall has come down. God bless you, HBO. You know what? They're wrong.
They're wrong about what? The Berlin Wall is not falling?
Well, it's big news. It happened sooner than we thought because, as we know, HBO provides a third of the profits for Time Warner. It's a huge profit driver for Time Warner. And as I said to you before the show began, to me, that indicates a bigger problem with the rest of Time Warner than it does with HBO. It doesn't make me think, whoa, there must be money on the table for HBO. They're hugely profitable. But you know what? Everyone who wants HBO has HBO. There aren't that many people who say, I do not want any cable, I don't want any satellite, I don't want anything, but I do want HBO.
You know what?
I think they would beg to differ with you.
I think that they would say, look, we're tracking the piracy of Game of Thrones and of Girls.
Those aren't people who want to buy HBO every month.
I agree with that. I would say, hey, you know what? No, we don't want HBO. We want that show. We don't want HBO.
Or they want to steal it.
Yes.
Yeah, and Game of Thrones is pirated because it's not opening in every country. It's highly pirated in some countries more than others. My point is they're looking at 10 million homes with broadband. Okay. Those 10 million homes with broadband that don't have a TV provider. And out of those homes, maybe do they think 10% of them want to have HBO? Because that would be a big get.
That would be. An extra million customers.
That's a million people. All right. So we don't know what the service is going to cost, but let's say $10 a month. So that would be an extra $10 million a month. Hey, it's an extra $120 million. That's good money. But they're talking about doubling Time Warner's profits, and they expect HBO to be a big driver of that. I don't think there's a ton of people who want HBO who don't already have it. There's a lot of people with cable who don't have HBO because it's too expensive. That's where I was. I had HBO for a while, and I stopped paying for it. I liked certain shows on it a lot, like Bill Maher and now in Deadwood and now Game of Thrones, but I didn't want to pay for it every month.
Okay, let's kind of go over this announcement and these announcements for some of our listeners, because there's a lot going on in them. Now, this was something that was kind of this investigation.
It came out of the blue, and we want to know why, because you and I both said it'd probably be a while before Time Warner messes with this hugely profitable goose that they have that lays the golden egg, and that's HBO. It's a third of Time Warner's profits. So why did they rush out this announcement as far as we're concerned? Came out of the blue, unexpected. Nobody thought it would happen this soon. Why did it happen now?
Well, if you listen to episode 234, 46-minute mark, of this show, Showbiz Sandbox, you'll hear us talking about how more and more networks and premium networks are going to go over the top, specifically over the top before the end of the year, especially with the, remember, Disney and DirecTV, they kind of cut this deal to sell direct to customers that, yeah, okay, so we said, well, look.
That was going to be a bundled service, though, sort of.
Yeah, it was going to be, but more and more, that over the top was the new black that everybody was talking about, like how they could do it. We didn't think HBO Go or HBO would
What's
go
not
for
HBO Go?
Yeah.
We don't know what the service is, but it's not necessarily HBO to Go. The HBO to Go is the service that if you have HBO, you can get or have access to HBO to Go, which means all their current shows on demand, all their back catalog of all their library of all their original programming they've ever done. We understand that this new service probably won't be that because they didn't call it HBO to Go. And therefore, the suspicion is maybe it will be just current seasons of current shows. There won't be the whole library of Sex and the City or The Sopranos at your beck and call. Maybe it won't even be past seasons of current shows. We don't know what it's going to contain. We don't know how much it's going to cost. But we know it's going to be some sort of current HBO programming, at least available for a monthly fee.
Right. Now, we also don't know exactly how it will be delivered. Now, you ask, why all of a sudden is this happening? Well, again, there's that whole Rupert Murdoch question, right? He came in with 21st Century Fox to do a takeover bid of Time Warner at $85 a share. We're not going to rehash that. However, at the time I thought the deal would go through, Michael, you said, no, it's probably not going to go through. When it didn't go through, I said, well, something's going to have to change because you can't, I mean, their stock was off 16% when this announcement was made.
So Time Warner said, hey, we're going to double our profits.
Right. Basically, Jeff Bukes is saying,
why did it take a takeover for you to want to double your profits?
Well, he's now saying, look, I know we didn't take that what seemed like a generous offer at the time. Bear with us. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut some staff. We're going to lower operating expense.
They're going to cut a lot of staff.
1,475 positions on the broadcast side. That's CNN, Cartoon Network, TBS, TNT, and about 1,000 positions at their Burbank studio. That's the
like
Warner Brothers studio.
10% of the Turner staff. The Turner unit is the TV side. That doesn't count HBO. That's, like you said, CNN, Cartoon Network, TBS, TNT. Then they're cutting a huge chunk out of the studio side.
1,000 positions.
Now, like 2,500 people are losing their job. That's how they're going to increase profits.
Well, that's one way. Then they're going to try and grow HBO. They're going to have this movie slate that includes more Harry Potter movies, more Lego movies.
It's not a Harry Potter movie. It's a movie set in the Harry Potter universe, or it's a J.K. Rowling movie. I don't know what to call it, but it's not a Harry Potter film.
Right. More franchise opportunities.
From the minds of J.K. Rowling.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, yeah, they're making a lot of tentpole films. So is every studio in the world. They've announced 10 DC movies. We're going to make DC movies from now to the end of time. And we're going to double our profits. But, again, you want to know, why did Rupert Murdoch have to try and take over your company for you to want to double your profits?
Well, you know, reading between the lines here, okay, there's also some other things to mention. And that is, while HBO may have said, hey, we're going to do the Netflix thing, because Netflix is doing the Netflix thing, going direct.
What's the Netflix thing?
Where they go direct to consumers over the top. Okay, we're going to kind of go around the, well, they don't even say they're going around the cable providers, because what they said is we're going to work with existing partners and new partners.
But we don't know how it's going to work yet.
We don't know how it's going to work.
They don't want to piss off their cable partners, and they don't want to certainly screw up all the money they make from HBO via cable services.
Right. And there's some speculation as to, well, maybe they did this to try and extract some better terms from the cable providers, who, by the way, pay for a majority, if not entirely, all of HBO's marketing. If they don't pay for their own marketing, they're now going to start doing their own marketing campaigns, HBO that is. But for the most part, HBO gets its marketing from the cable operators.
It's a trade-off, right? Well, so I wouldn't say it's for free. It's like, you know, we'll charge you X amount of dollars, but you will also provide in-kind marketing. That's not exactly for free or whatever. That's just a business deal.
Right.
They do marketing. They do make sure marketing is out there. There's tons of ads for HBO. It's just done as an in-kind thing in trade for, okay, we won't charge you as much as we would, but you're going to give us $100 million in marketing.
Well, now the mainstream press focused mostly on this HBO deal, all this HBO news. Uh-huh. However, the tech press, while focusing on HBO, also brought this little tidbit up quite a bit. And that is Jeff Bukes, the CEO of HBO's parent company, Time Warner. He's the CEO of the whole kit and caboodle. He was asked specifically.
Yeah, but let's not quote him at length. Basically, he said, where do you stand on net neutrality? And he said, well, you know what? If you want something, you're going to have to pay for it.
Right. He said there's going to be an evolution of financial support to pay for, to continue to maintain the ability of the broadband infrastructure to do digital delivered programming.
Oh, my God. That's the worst quote in the world. You're going to have to pay more if you want all this video coming over your inner tubes.
Right. Well,
that's what he said.
But the U here is not.
Think they still own Time Warner Cable? Does he not know they're not a cable provider? They don't provide internet service?
Yes, he does know that. Okay. But what he's saying is, and this is a translation of what he's saying, we, Time Warner, will pay you extra for the traffic we send through your pipes. In other words,
but that's stupid because all those other people already pay extra and they pay a lot of money to have the support and the technical service in place so that you can get traffic over the internet quickly and speedily. That's not the point. Nobody is saying, I want to do all this and have you pay for it. Somebody else pay for it. Nobody has said, oh, you know, the ISP should spend $8 gazillion so I can send 3D video over the internet. No.
Right.
Netflix and everybody else is already paying tons of money to make sure that their service is available quickly and efficiently. Consumers pay tons of money, the highest in the world, for high quality internet service. But the internet providers, the internet service providers, want to double charge everybody. They're giving us the crappiest service in the world. And they also want to make other people like Netflix or in the future HBO, who pay lots of money to make sure their service is functioning properly.
Right.
They want to make them pay a fee as well.
Why is all of this important? Because what HBO
is... Jeff Bukes is an idiot.
What HBO and what Time Warner is saying is Netflix is fighting you on this. And as an ISP, you are also a cable provider. Okay. And what we just told you is we're going to be taking away one of the products that you sell, and it's going to be going more and more over the top and more less and less. It's going to be delivered by another service you offer, which is called
cable.
So
you're telling me Time Warner just told consumers, screw you.
No,
we don't give
a
damn about you. You have the shittiest cable service in the world, the shittiest internet service in the world, and we don't give a damn.
No, this has nothing to do with consumers.
Yes, it does, because they're refusing to take the side of the consumers. They're saying, screw you. We don't care about you. All we care about is us, and we don't care about what you're doing. We're not going to look at the broad picture of what's best for us long-term with net neutrality. We're just going to be stupid morons and try to stay in bed with internet service providers who we shouldn't give a damn about. And instead, they're throwing consumers under the bus, throwing their competitors under the bus, ignoring what's best for them long-term by cozying up to the internet service providers who do a crappy, crappy job and will throw them over a barrel and take every penny from them that they can down the road if HBO is stupid enough to let them do it.
Let's just calm down for a second. Let me try and
I can't believe you're defending him.
No, I'm not defending him. I'm trying to explain what it means, okay? And what it means...
What it means is that he's being an idiot and not thinking long term.
What it means, it has nothing to do... At the outset, it has nothing to do with the actual consumer, you and I, as a consumer. What it has to do with is, in one breath, they're saying, we are saying something that's going to make you very mad, cable operators. We're saying that we're going to offer HBO directly to consumers, possibly going around...
They're trying to placate internet service providers.
Now, that said, okay, we are going to stop fighting you, okay, on net neutrality.
So HBO wasn't fighting them on net neutrality.
Time Warner was. They're not anymore. That is exactly what Jeff...
Well, that's pretty stupid, isn't it? That's exactly what I'm talking about. They now need net neutrality more than ever, and they've just decided to throw in the towel.
I know.
If HBO is going over the top, they should care about net neutrality more. We want to pay extra. We want to pay lots of money for sending this over the top. That's their genius decision. First of all, somebody tries to take them over and say, well, you know what? We're going to double our profits. Well, you should be fired because why didn't you want to double your profits anyway? Now you're taking HBO over the top, and therefore you should care about net neutrality. And we're using that term in a very generic sense, you know, to mean what we all know it should mean. We're not talking about any specific rules that are in place now, but just the general idea that you shouldn't have to pay double or pay twice or be held hostage by internet service providers, you know, who are lying about capacity just to try and squeeze more money out of you. We're now, HBO should care more about net neutrality than ever. And they are saying, well, we'll give up.
Well, one would think that. I totally agree that, like, okay, so wait, you just said you're going to pay more for water, yet you're becoming a pool company. Yeah. Okay, wait, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you say, oh, we're really going to fight net neutrality now because, you know, it's going to really affect us?
Because they're thinking short term.
Yes, they are really. I think this is a short term. They're trying to appease these ISPs who are also, of course, cable operators. And they're trying to say, look, we know you're going to lose money because fewer and fewer people are going to, you know, buy cable from you. But don't worry, we're going to be using your ISP more and more, and we're willing to pay for that. Oh, by the way, who isn't? Netflix. Okay, so
they panicked.
I think they panicked a bit.
They
panicked
over the Rupert Murdoch takeover. They panicked in their reaction. They're taking the one channel that is already a huge cash cow for them and saying, oh, we're going to squeeze a ton more money out of it. I don't know.
And quite honestly, I think that right now, I think ultimately what we will wind up with is, yeah, you can get HBO on its own, $20 per month. But if you get it through Comcast or Time Warner Cable or DirecTV, it'll be like, you know, $9 a month.
Okay. So Netflix stock tumbled over this news briefly, even though
just this news. I think it was also the fact that they did not, Netflix, that is, live up to the expectations of their subscriber growth. Because let's face it, at some point you hit a plateau.
Well, actually, you know, they a year ago they earned 52 cents per share. This year they earned 96 pence per share. A year ago they had revenue of $1.1 billion. This time they announced $1.4 billion. They were slightly off on their estimates of how many people they would sign up, despite the fact that they had increased their total bill by $1 or $2 a month, which is a lot when you're talking about a service that costs $8, $9, $10 a month, right?
Speaking of which, something that was very quiet was that Netflix right now, if you create content for Netflix, you have to deliver it in 4K. So I'm not talking about movies. I'm talking about Orange is the New Black or House of Cards. They shoot it in 4K. You have to finish it in 4K, which is expensive, okay? No pun intended. I just said okay too many times.
Well, they make their own, so that's theirs.
That's theirs, right. But now if you're making content that they're buying, then you have to make it in 4K. By the way,
they're refusing to. What do you mean you have to? They're saying we won't buy your show because it's not in 4K.
Yes,
so
you
they
have
don't
to deliver
want Cheers.
It.
They don't want Cheers.
Not existing content.
They just bought Friends.
Original content. Original
well, like,
content.
Well, like what? They're not buying. What are you talking about?
Well,
what shows are you referring to? Like a new CBS show?
No, I'm talking about a show made specifically for.
Well, but they're paying
Netflix.
For it.
Correct. So that said.
So who cares?
Now you're paying for it because if you want the 4K stream, you have to pay an extra $2 or $3 per month.
Yes, they have premium services available. Yes.
They raise their
Who
price.
Who cares? They raise their prices $1 or $2 a month, and they still met their earnings, their share earnings. They exceeded their revenue estimates. They were slightly off on their subscriber base. And you know what? As they said, you know, we've predicted our subscriber base a lot. Sometimes we overestimate, sometimes we underestimate, but we're not consistently underestimating just so we can show it went beyond it. We're actually trying to name what we're trying to hit. And this time we were a little short despite raising our prices substantially. So I thought that the fact that their stock tumbled was silly. I think the fact that they tumbled over HBO was silly. Do you think, oh, I can get HBO now, I don't want Netflix? The offerings of Netflix are so dramatically bigger in my mind.
No, well, unlike music where the Beatles, that's a bad example. The Beatles are kind of special, but like the Beach Boys, okay, they can be on both Spotify and Ardio and Deezer.
I get around, yeah. Sorry.
So their music is getting around because it can be on any one of those services. And yes, you probably would get Beats Music and then not get Spotify. In this case, if Orange is the New Black is on Netflix, it's not going to be on HBO. So the content will be different on each one of those services. So as Reed Hastings, of course, now is saying, Reed Hastings, the head of Netflix, he's saying, oh, we can both coexist. You'll pay for HBO, you'll pay for Netflix. What I want to say is you're going to be paying for that. You're going to be paying for this. You're going to be paying quite a lot of money with all this unbundling.
Well, he, you know, I don't think he's in the same game. I think the library that Netflix offers, like their signing of the reruns of Friends, I think it's just a very different beast from what HBO offers. HBO offers, you know, their original material. Netflix offers as wide a library as possible. They have such a bigger range of stuff, you know, with all the back catalog of all the shows that they show. I know they change all the time and come in and out, and there's old movies and old TV shows. But to me, it's just a very different, much broader range of stuff that they offer than just HBO.
Does Netflix offer CBS programming?
I don't know.
Well,
they may have had the rights. CBS famously stayed out of Hulu. And of course, the day after HBO announced they were going over the top, so did CBS.
Yes, yeah, CBS Access All In. And by all in, we mean we want every single word in the name of this product. Access All In. Wow. Okay. $6 a month to access all of CBS's content via a website or an app. Quite honestly, I heard that and went, yeah, not from me. You're not getting $6.
Well, you know, you can stream your local service. You can watch all the original stuff. There are, you know, Netflix offers discs of shows, of course, once they're available, like The Big Bang Theory.
Right.
I'm sure there are some shows that are available on streaming, but I don't know. Maybe they're not. So if you're a Netflix DVD subscriber, yes, you can access CBS shows. You can access everything, including HBO, once they're available, I think, right, on DVD. But as far as current shows, I don't believe they offer it on streaming service.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think you have to watch it on their own, on CBS.com or on their own website.
That's right. So CBS offered this, HBO is offering this, and my question is, why not buy an antenna?
You'd have to actually put it up on the roof.
And that's true. And also, you're saying that in a few years there will be problems with your antenna signal.
Yes, but if we got into that, I mean, that's, we're talking about 4K content now and the
ability. Antenna, or you could just buy the most basic offering from your cable provider. Some people said, look, I pay $15 a month and I get 15 channels. I get all the networks, PBS, CNN, and this and that.
Right.
You know, if you're just saying, I just want a few things like CBS, you know, HBO is what, $15, maybe $10? Who knows what they'll charge? CBS is charging $6. Netflix can be $12. Hulu Prime can be $8. You know what? That's $41 and counting. And you don't have most of the major networks, PBS, or most of the channels you watch every day. So people talk about how they want to cut the cord. This is what it costs.
Yeah,
$6 for CBS, $10 or $15 for HBO, $12 for Netflix, $8 for Hulu Prime. And most of the things you want are not available on those channels.
Well, think about it this way. That's how cable companies started, right? They all said, oh, look, all these channels are charging you money. But you know what? Just get it from us and we'll bundle it and we'll make it cheaper for you.
No, all those channels are free.
Well, yet I'm talking about these new networks, the MTV, the HBO.
No. Cable said you get TV for free, but pay us and we'll give you more channels and more TVs and stuff than you've ever seen before.
Right.
That was their deal.
Right. And now they're going to do the same thing, but on the internet side.
No, it's less. What are you talking about?
I think that ultimately what they will do.
Who's they?
Cable operators. They know they're losing their cable business. They know and realize that everything is going over the top.
Right.
And as you say, you want HBO, $15, CBS, $6, Netflix, $12. Hey, you want all of that bundled up? Because then HBO will cost you $9. CBS will cost you $4.
Well, but it's the same. That's what cable is. I mean, a TV provider.
We're arguing over the technology.
Cable. No. It doesn't matter whether it's satellite, cable, or internet. Cable companies or TV providers say, look, bundle the services together and you get a lot more channels with a lot better service than you can do individually. You couldn't even get it individually. Now you can. Guess what? Look, it's expensive. That's why there will always be bundling. And that's why most people will not want to go a la carte. They think they do, but they don't.
I agree. I think that ultimately, well, I'll say this. There are some people like myself. I don't watch that much television.
I know people who don't have TV at all, but yeah. I just think the vast majority do. And I think once you start to add it up, oh, golly, I got to pay for CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, PBS. And then you hear about a show and you don't have BBC America or you don't have FX or you don't have, you know, you don't have AMC. You can't watch The Walking Dead. You know what? These shows are, you know, they're not going to take off like the way they should when you can't just turn over a channel and start watching them.
Well, I don't know if you can tell if you're listening to us still, but all of this is definitely important news. I mean, these were all important news stories this week.
What are you trying to say?
I'm trying to say it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. That's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now we're going to whip through some of these stories. Our first story is about our favorite person, NPH, and he's hosting the AA. Wait, actually, that came out wrong. Not the AA, but the...
he's not in rehab.
Yes. He is Neil Patrick Harris, that is. He is hosting the Oscars. The multi-hyphenated actor and author has already hosted the Tonys.
And magician.
Yes. Actually, he was the president, if not, is still the president of the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles. You have to be a magician to get in to the Magic Castle. He hosted the Tonys. He's hosted the Emmys. He's going for the trifecta here with the Oscars under his belt. Harris will be gunning for the heretofore unimagined grand slam of hosting duties if only he can get someone to let him host the Grammys. Wow, that would be, he would literally have a hat trick, right? Although a hat trick is three. So,
that's right.
Hey, he starred in musicals. It's widely seen as a smart, safe step back from having a Johnny come lately like Seth MacFarlane hosts, although I guess anything would be a safe bet after that. Harris can be cheeky, but he's clearly part of the Hollywood slash theatrical slash TV slash showbiz community. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I'm surprised he's not hosting my Sunday dinner party. You know, he's everywhere.
Wasn't that actually one of the jokes in like the Muppet movie a couple years back? Not the Muppets. Was it Muppets Take Man? I don't, can't remember which one it was, but they were doing a telethon. And Neil Patrick Harris was on the phone kind of, you know, taking pledges. And at one point he said to one of the caller, somebody he said, I don't know. I don't know why I'm not hosting this. You're right.
You know, it's funny. He's openly gay, of course, and nobody even thinks to mention, oh, he's the first openly gay person to host the Oscars. Actually, I'll
Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh, that's right. Ellen did it. He's, you know, he's one of the first open to give you.
Yeah. Basically, your argument is moot.
Well, you know, it just doesn't, even if he wasn't the first, it doesn't mean anything anymore. People aren't caught up in it. They don't. And in fact, you know, an actor was just cast as The Flash in one of those many movies that Warner Brothers and Time Warner announced is The Flash, a feature film version of that superhero, not linked to the TV show. And they announced their star would be Ezra Miller, an actor who was in The Perks of Being a Wallflower. That was probably one of his biggest roles so far. And he identifies as queer.
Okay.
And he's going to be playing the lead in a superhero movie. Now, maybe you can correct me again, but he is the hero in a superhero film, and we believe he's the first actor as with such an identity to do so. Ian McKellen played a villain in the X-Men movies.
Where I was going.
And Ellen Page was cast in X-Men as one of the small, minor characters, Kitty Pryde, but she was cast before she came out.
Okay.
So, you know, this movie isn't scheduled for 2018. He'll probably have some cameo roles in earlier DC movies that are coming out. But you know what? Nobody even barely caused a ripple. So, you know, we're pretty close to the day when there will be openly gay actors and actresses starring in action films, big franchise movies, and nobody will think twice.
The Hollywood Reporter had a story recently headlined, and this is a quote, Steve McQueen drama lands HBO pilot order, casts its star. And the photo was of a young man who looked nothing like Steve McQueen. Of course, they weren't referring to the iconic actor. They were referring to the director and producer of the Oscar-winning film 12 Years a Slave, who, by the way, is an Oscar winner himself. But the confusion didn't end there. The show is called Codes of Conduct and will star the unknown Devon Terrell as Beverly Snow, a young black man from Queens who is as talented as he is ambiguous. His self-confidence enables him to break into the social circles of Manhattan's elite, testing the boundaries of access and social mobility. And that's a quote. Wasn't that Six Degrees of Separation? I think so. Though sounding identical to the premise of the smash hit play by John Guare, the show is not based on that property. Have your lawyer call my lawyer, and Michael, while they're chatting, tell me, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I mean, this sounds awfully like Six Degrees of Separation.
It's the exact same story.
I'm sure as it plays out in a 8-part or whatever part series it will be, it would be different, but my God.
Yeah.
It literally sounds exactly like that. And I made the Steve McQueen mistake myself.
Okay. Well, good news for consumers. Obviously not good news on the net neutrality front, as Michael just pointed out. The average price of a movie ticket has fallen. That's the headline in Variety. According to the National Association of Theater Owners, the average ticket price fell almost 4% from the previous year, or the previous quarter, I should say, from $8.38 to $8.08. Mind you, that's technically true, but completely misleading on several levels. First, they're comparing the average ticket price as we head into fall compared to the heart of summer, which comes loaded with IMAX and 3D fare, so fewer movies with premium prices even available means a lower average ticket price. Comparing grosses in quarters, one after another, is also misleading for that very reason. In fact, average ticket price this quarter compared to the same quarter last year, so year over year, the ticket price has actually risen from $7.84, the same quarter in 2013, to $8.08 in 2014.
So a quarter, practically a quarter.
Yes. But maybe saying the average ticket price has grown doesn't make for the same audience-friendly headline. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. You know, prices keep going up. Too many movies with too many high ticket prices, too much 3D fare. No matter how you slice and dice it, it costs more and more to go to the movies. And I think it's a bad thing.
Twin Peaks co-creator Mark Frost has a story to tell. His new book, The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks, fills readers in on what's happened during the last 25 years since the popular television series ended. It comes out late in 2015, before the show's 2016 revival, and has already been sold around the world, including the UK, Germany, Brazil, and so on. Presumably, Japan is on that list, or at least will be soon. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's a tie-in to the reboot of the series. I mentioned Japan because I remember they had, like, travel packages going to the areas where Twin Peaks was sold. I mean, they loved the show. It was a hugely popular show in Japan. But this is, I mean, I just started rewatching the show because it came out on Blu-ray. I'm sitting down with friends to watch Twin Peaks from beginning to, not end, but to the end of the mystery. And then maybe I'll watch more later. But oh my God, suddenly the show is back in everywhere. It's got the TV show coming. There's a book so you can catch up. It's unbelievable. Twin Peaks has never been hotter.
I thought Orange was the New Black, not Twin Peaks. The Nielsen Ratings Company has snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. That's right, you heard that correctly. Defeat from the jaws of victory. Before their rating snafu was announced, which we covered on last week's episode, the company claimed that ABC's evening newscast had trumped NBC's for the first time in years. Not so fast, David Muir. In fact, Brian Williams and NBC remain the champs. There's still no explanation of why ABC benefited from the glitch and other networks suffered, but Williams isn't asking any questions. He's just sighing with relief and patting Muir on the head, saying, "Nice try, kid." Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, this is why they have to go back and fix the numbers. I still don't understand why they're not going back to when the snafu began, but they're just going back to August. And, you know, my head spins over TV ratings. You know, we just don't know what's going on. We saw, what's it called? The Walking Dead. That's now up with DVR from 3 days. That's up to like 23 million viewers.
Wow.
So we don't even have a full week's numbers. And we don't know about when they're incorporating, you know, rebroadcast reruns during that week. So I guess it'll be like 28 million people, just like it was last season. Not that that number ever gets out. Why the networks don't do a better job of trumpeting all the people watching TV, no matter where they watch it, I don't know.
Did the pop star Lord say something unhip or worse, something anti-liberal? Her signature tune, Royals, has been banned by radio stations in San Francisco.
How does that song go again, Sperling?
We could be Royals.
I thought you were going to sing it. Oh, well, keep going.
Most likely, even covers of her signature tune, Royals, have been banned. So no Bruce Springsteen singing Lord either. What in heaven's name has Lord done? What do you think she's done? It's right there in the title, actually. Royals. With the World Series looming, local fans of the San Francisco Giants do not want to hear the word Royals, as in Kansas City Royals, playing over their airwaves. Meanwhile, stations in Kansas City pledge to play the song every hour on the hour until victory is theirs. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because what's going to happen today might be Giants. I guess Kansas City won't play their songs anymore.
Yes. Well, so for those outside the United States, World Series is, of course, the championship of Major League Baseball. And the San Francisco Giants are playing the Kansas City Royals. The Royals haven't been in the World Series in 29 years.
It's going to be exciting. I'm rooting for the Kansas City.
Who isn't?
Sorry, San Francisco.
Who isn't rooting for them? I think the entire country is rooting for them because they literally were in last place. And now they're in the World Series. They, I think, went from like worst to first overnight. I'm sure that they would disagree with that and say that they had clawed their way back over years. But, you know, it's a team that is generally not a contender.
Mm-hmm.
But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We've talked about this before. We're going to talk about it again. Amazon, you know, that company online, they sell, what is the name I'm looking for? Everything.
Everything.
Action. Yeah. But they also sell books. They are the largest online bookseller. I would say they may even be the largest bookseller, period, in the world. And they cut a new deal with Simon & Schuster, one of the big publishers out there, even while they continue to struggle with their relationship with Hachette, another big publisher.
It's exciting news.
It is. Well, you're in the publishing business. Is it exciting news to you?
Well, it's interesting news. Basically, depends who you are. It seems to have brought back agency pricing.
Should we explain what agency pricing is?
We certainly should. That's sort of where the publisher has more control over what you sell a book for.
They say, hey, you know what? We're charging, as the publisher, $15 for this book. Now, Amazon, iTunes, anybody out there who wants to sell this book, you can keep 30% of that, but we're selling it for $15. You can't reprice it.
I'm not sure if that's exactly how it works. There is some flexibility, but you're limited, and you know they're going to get a certain amount of the cut of the book. You can't just undersell a book for $8, lose $5 on every purchase, and drive everybody out of business.
Right.
That's the purpose of agency pricing. This is the model that Apple and all the big publishers embraced. They got slapped down by the government for the manner in which they did it. But in the agreement that came out of all of that suing and counter-suing and deals with the government, it was agreed that agency pricing itself is not wrong or illegal, and that once their certain time passed, these publishers could again start embracing agency pricing if they chose. That time has passed for Simon & Schuster. They're making a deal with Amazon, and they said, we're going to have a version. That's the quote, a version of agency pricing. That's what Simon & Schuster says. There will be limited exceptions. That's, again, a quote from them. But they say, in general, we'll be able to set the price, and we're not going to have these massive discounts that can drive all of Amazon's competitors out of business. Amazon, however, says there is an incentive for Simon & Schuster to lower their prices. Simon & Schuster says, everything's great.
What does Amazon say?
Well, Amazon says, hey, look, the way the deal is structured, Simon & Schuster will want to lower prices. It's better for everybody. They'll sell more books. They'll make more money, et cetera. Of course, one of the other things they said was, what we really care about is the author.
Yeah, I buy that. No pun intended.
And the question is, did authors benefit? You know, Amazon said at one point, well, we just really want to make sure authors make more money off ebooks. Well, from what we can tell, that hasn't happened. In this deal, Simon & Schuster proudly told their authors this deal, quote, maintains the author's share of income from ebook sales, end quote. And that means thanks for nothing, Simon & Schuster, because they didn't want to maintain it. They wanted to get more from ebook sales. As in so many other new formats, authors were told, oh, no, we have to give you a lower rate on ebooks than we do with hardcovers because we're just not going to make any money off this. Meanwhile, of course, ebooks explode. So yeah. Authors have been getting the short end of the stick. If you're really big, you can perhaps make some new deals. But basically, they've had a lower royalty rate than they would like. Amazon tried to use that as some leverage to try to get authors on their side. It didn't work. And in the final deal, authors are not gaining any ground.
Well, Paul Krugman, who I believe is the Nobel-winning economist, I think he's won a Nobel Prize for economics. He says in an op-ed out today in the New York Times that in economics jargon, Amazon is not, at least so far, acting like a monopolist, a dominant seller with the power to raise prices. Instead, it is acting as a monopsonist, a dominant buyer with the power to push prices down. The prices it's pushing down, of course, are the prices it pays for its product to the manufacturer.
And to put that in layman's terms, that means they're just being big fat jerks.
Yeah. I mean, and he goes on and on. And it's a wonderful piece because I think he's absolutely correct. He's saying that if a book isn't on Amazon, it's not creating buzz. And buzz is what actually sells books, you know, word of mouth and bestseller lists and book tours. That's what sells books. And if it's not on Amazon and Amazon doesn't carry that book, you're much less likely to hear about it in the first place. Well, and he goes, I mean, it's a perfectly written and perfect argument, actually.
Well, he's saying it's not a monopoly as such, but it is still doing things that are bad for, you know, the business and unfair practices. And it's like Standard Oil. They were not a monopoly as such, but they had so much power that they could negatively influence the economy and the area in the economy in which they acted. And therefore, rightly, he says, the government stepped in and broke it up. And right. So he's suggesting that action needs to be taken against Amazon. You don't have to be a monopoly in order to be doing something bad that people should be unhappy about.
Right. And I guess one thing he pointed out, he said, look, it's not just about prices and it's not just about the economy. It's also about the way it's throwing its weight around. And he gave an example of there's a book about the Koch brothers who are kind of this very conservative. They invest in politics quite a bit, in conservative causes. The book is very critical of the Koch brothers, and there's like a 3-week wait for it.
It's from Hachette.
Yeah, it's from
Hachette. But another book from Hachette is by Paul Ryan, a conservative person that Amazon maybe doesn't want to tick off. And therefore, the implication is that they are making political decisions about who they want to annoy or curry favor with. And therefore, that's one of the things that they're doing, throwing their weight around in order to hide a book by somebody that is negative of people in power and supporting a book by a person of power. And therefore, he's saying, look, that can be dangerous.
Right.
And of course, lots of independent stores might carry the Koch brothers book right up front because they thought it was good and well written and they don't like the Koch brothers, while the Paul Ryan book, they may not want to carry at all.
Yes, but it's an independent bookseller that can only appeal to, you can't appeal to 300 million people.
Exactly. So, and also looking at prices, there are two books right now that are very hot titles from Simon & Schuster. One is All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, and that's priced at like $5, as well as The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. That also is priced at $5 as an ebook. That's awfully low.
Yes.
You know, so those are Simon & Schuster books. They're heavily discounted. Whether that will continue, we'll have to see. Is it great to get books really cheap? Yes. But, you know, if you're killing out all the other bookstores in the world to do it, and then you find out 5 years from now that nobody's carrying books because Amazon's moved on to something else, maybe you won't be so happy about it.
Well, let's talk about those two books for a second, only in so much as I want to know, those are two hot titles, All the Light We Cannot See. Any good?
It's one of the best books of the year, I think. I've read it. I loved it. I think it's just terrific. It's a work of fiction set around World War II, about a young blind girl and her father and their struggle to survive while bombing is occurring in their country. It's just a lovely work. I really liked it a lot. I have not read The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. I think it's been optioned for film already.
It has, yes.
Yes, it's a acclaimed work about a kid from a poor background
in Jersey. New Jersey.
Who heads off to college and does not make it.
Well, he makes it in college, but then
he gets to college on a football scholarship, but he does not segue into a happy and productive life.
Correct.
As you would guess from the title, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. So that's supposed to be just a terrific book. I've got it on my shelf ready to read. I would highly recommend, if that intrigued you at all, to check it out, as well as the All the Light We Cannot See.
Well, some other people who didn't make it, at least into this week, we have some news about them as well. But first is...
Oh, that's, we're segueing into obituaries.
Yes,
oh.
That was my segue.
They didn't make it into this week. Oh, dear me.
Was that a bad segue? I was trying to move us along.
No, that's quite all right. It was just the segue.
Okay. Well, Misty Upham passed away. Now, you may not know who she is. She is a Native American actress. She starred in Frozen River with Melissa Leo, a great movie if you get to see it. She was also in August Osage County with Meryl Streep. And she kind of suffered from bipolar disorder and was reportedly off her medication. But the family believes her death was actually an accident, that she didn't commit suicide, as was originally reported. Her body was found in a ravine, and the family and community are upset with the Auburn Police Department, which has had a difficult relationship with the Muckleshoot Reservation, which is where Upham lived. The family says that they went to the police repeatedly expressing concern but were ignored, and locals had to organize search parties on their own to go and try and find her, and they, I suppose, were too late.
Yes, it was a sad end to a life of a pretty talented actress. She was very good in Frozen River, and it was a shame to hear how it all ended.
Well, Oscar De La Renta, you probably know his name. He's a fashion designer who remained kind of this major figure in fashion for 60 years. He died of cancer at 82 just last night.
Yes. Was it last night? Oh, by the way, that Paul Krugman article appeared 2 days ago. It was in the 20th, actually.
Okay.
But anyway, it's, you know, by the time people listen to it, it'll be 3 days.
Okay.
Oscar De La Renta, kind of fascinating. I'm not a big fashion person, but reading up on his life, I do like obituaries. I don't know if that makes me ghoulish or just getting older. But, you know, he really had a couple big stages to his career. And he was a real go-getter. He was not an incredibly talented fashion designer. I mean, he's probably in the Fashion Hall of Fame, but people don't talk about him as an innovative, important talent, but he knew how to stay on top. And just hearing his life and how he was a player and he got this job and then he swung it and you got that job and then move. He was a real go-getter. He could have been fine in Hollywood. He made fashion designers part of high society. And that started back in 1980 when the New York Times Magazine did a profile of him. Then he segued into, you know, designing for first ladies. That began with Nancy Reagan. And he did all the first ladies for quite a few years. Hillary Clinton once joked, he's been trying to make me a fashion icon for 20 years. You know, because she's not a big fashion plate. And he even chided Michelle Obama for wearing foreign labels a couple years ago. Some people said that was because she hadn't worn an Oscar De La Renta outfit yet. He says, no. I just feel she should support American designers. And ultimately, she did just a few weeks ago, right before he died, as it turned out.
Well, and then, actually, her dresses for the inaugurations, Michelle Obama's, that is.
We're not talking about the inaugurations. Okay. We're talking about in general. She wore foreign labels, and he said she shouldn't.
Okay.
We're not talking about that. It's not the point. We know she has supported other American fashion designers, but she also wore foreign labels, and he said, shouldn't do it. Now it's probably going to be a thing where no first lady can ever wear any dress that isn't designed in America. So that's where we're at politically. But he did become a red carpet staple in Hollywood. Penelope Cruz, Sarah Jessica Parker, Amy Adams, and he had a final coup right before he died. He designed the wedding dress for Mrs. George Clooney at that big wedding in Italy.
Also passing away over the past week was...
This one is for you, Sperling. I feel like this is a very important one for you.
Wait a second. I didn't even see. This is the problem when I don't read the obituaries before we start. It's Aaron Saritsky. He's the producer of the softcore Emmanuel feature films. He was 72.
You know, you watched at least one of them.
I actually have never seen any of these movies.
Complete?
Complete. He bought the rights to Emmanuel back when porn was not readily available in the home, and he called it erotica, or at least it was called erotica, and he made the genre more respectable. The 1974 film starred Sylvia Kristel as the remarkably promiscuous wife of a French diplomat. It played in one theater on the Champs-Élysées for more than 13 years and spawned more than 80 sequels on film, TV, and straight to video. When Columbia saw the film drew more females than males in the audience, it snatched the film up, made it their first X-rated release. Take that, United Artists and your stupid midnight cowboy. And they gave it the tagline, X was never like this.
Can't believe you never, ever saw...
Emmanuel?
Yes. Well, you know, there you go. A man dear to your heart, nonetheless.
Yes. Well, somebody who was dear to my heart was Elizabeth Peña, the actress. She died at the age of 55. No idea why. She died after a brief illness in Los Angeles. You may know her from La Bamba. You may know her as she had a recurring guest role on Modern Family most recently. She played the mother of Sofia Vergara. She played the voice in The Incredibles. She did one of the voices of the evil villain's assistant.
That's right. And so I don't think we still know exactly what happened, but it's a shame to hear.
Yes. I mean, it kind of talk about out of the blue. That definitely was a bit surprising.
Yes.
But that's pretty much it for this week. If you have any comments or feedback or want to write to us, you can. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where we can be found. And we do urge you and love it when you subscribe to the show. It does help us out, especially if you rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to all those ways to subscribe to us. links to all those ways to contact us or even follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where we are at facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week you can find him at a different location. Where is it this week, Michael?
It's at michaelgiltzisgoingoverthetop.com.
That's a little long, so if you want to find some of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry, or Broadway or publishing, try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post or bookfilter.com. That's also where you can find some of his writing. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.